people buy books now is they look at a thumbnail and decide if they like it, or they hear word of mouth, or, you know, influencers or blogs, or get sort of indications of what's good to read to your kids. And so I think that this is an exciting time of innovation for kids' books and all types of publishing.
Welcome to Literary Gumbo 2.0. This is the reboot of a video program I co-produced between 2010 and 2017. I'm your host, Lisa Engel. The right angle to help you write and sell your story. Each episode explores the world of writing, publishing, and book marketing. Sit back and enjoy.
I am here today with artist and illustrator Christina Wald. She's done over 60 children's books and artwork for many other kinds of books and magazines. Welcome, Christina.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
So, how did you get into illustrating?
You know, I had always wanted to be an illustrator. And actually, when I went to school, most schools don't offer illustration programs. So I actually went to school for an industrial design program rather than illustration. And after I finished school, I just started showing my portfolio around, and I wanted to really do comics, but I was very slow at that point. You know, when you're in your early 20s. And obviously, to set context for people that are younger that might be listening, there was no digital art. So everything was completely done by hand. And I was a bit slow. So I actually started doing role-playing game art in the 90s. So I did work for Dungeons and Dragons and Wizards of the Coast and some card games based on Lord of the Rings. So it was a good place to kind of get trained. And that's sort of how I started doing illustration. And obviously my journey has been a very long one. I don't know how far you want me to go into it. I could.
Well, how did you first get into illustrating for children's books?
Well, what had happened was I had probably for the decade of the 90s, I did a lot of role-playing game artwork. And sort of at the end of the 90s, several companies that I worked for went under. And so I started refocusing my portfolio, and I worked at an ad agency for a couple of years. And then, like in the early 2000s, I got contacted by Scholastic to do Scholastic magazines, which was, they would do these wonderful see-through issues where, like, on one side, it would show a scene with all these animals, or, you know, they had a bunch of different types of them. I did ones with animals. And then you would hold it up to the light and print it on the back, you would see hidden stuff. So the first one I did was of a garden, and you saw all the animals, and then you saw the dirt. And when you held it up to the light, you could see all the roots and the animals under and the earthworms and all that sort of thing. So that's kind of how I started doing children's magazines. And then shortly after, I started getting contacted by people to do children's books. I got contacted by Grosset and Dunlop, which is part of Penguin. I got contracted by Publications International to do a book on animals of the world. And I just sort of started getting all these books on animals. And that's sort of how it started around, I guess that was probably between 2003, 2004.
And then you've done a lot for the traditional publishers.
Yes.
What about indie authors?
I have done, I think most of my work was sort of traditional publishing I think indie has been sprinkled in. I have certainly done stuff for fairly small publications. And really in recent years, I've been doing more and more of it as publishing has changed, because when I started, there was a lot more in place to make the how you released a book and how people did media and that sort of thing, how all of that worked was different sort of, or evolving, than it is now, if that makes sense. You know, and I don't know if maybe COVID accelerated that, but really, the way people buy things now is all online. And that probably has been somewhat disastrous for, you know, book companies. And I suppose you have kind of a trifecta too, with libraries and schools not having the funds anymore either. So I think you're seeing a transition of how the whole marketplace works.
Definitely. The whole digital revolution.
And yes.
Exacerbated by the, or increased by the pandemic. And, but some of it's really nice, really good. Like the whole Zoom thing, everybody.
Yes, just, yes.
It's kind of thankful for that. But indie publishing, with all these big houses going, either joining each other and becoming super monsters, and and then these little ones popping up, it's kind of like the Wild West there in publishing, seems like.
It really has transitioned in a big way. And I think it's because never could you get such good quality as you can now when you publish a book. Now, when you publish a book, you still have to commit to making it a decent product. So you can't just have someone that doesn't know, you can't just like design it yourself in Word and, you know, send it to a printer and hope somebody's going to buy it. I mean, people are still able to tell from a professionally produced product to something that seems, I don't want to use the word amateurish, because that's probably not quite the right word, but you actually can get, you know, with print on demand, all the different ways you can make your book, it really looks no different than anything anyone else gets. As a matter of fact, I think even bigger publishers are doing smaller and smaller print runs, because again, there's, and this gets into the logistics of being a publishing business with warehousing and, you know, shipping and all that stuff. I think it's only certain books that get printed in the millions. I know when I first started, like one of my first books that I did for Grosset and Dunlop was put in the Scholastic Book Club. So they printed a ton of those. And I don't know if they do those sorts of print runs anymore. I mean, obviously they still have Scholastic Book Club, but it really has, I mean, I think the way a lot of people buy books now is they look at a thumbnail and decide if they like it, or they hear word of mouth, or, you know, influencers or blogs, or get sort of indications of what's good to read to your kids. And so I think that this is an exciting time of innovation for kids' books and all types of publishing, but it requires an entrepreneurial spirit that's quite a bit different too. Like, you can't, I think if you're waiting for someone to sort of publish you, you're going to be waiting a long time. And actually that is what I'm seeing with a lot of friends that are writers and illustrators, that unfortunately a lot of times now going through the traditional methods is extremely slow. Like, if you got a manuscript bought today, it would not be out for years. And yes.
That is why a lot of people that I have talked to do decide to go ahead and indie publish. And that's even one of the reasons why I decided to indie publish as well. And then a lot of those people are just talking about print books. A lot of novels are just print books. But when you come into something with a lot of illustrations and color drawings, that gets a little bit more complicated. Well, a lot
it
more.
It really does. It really does. I mean, obviously, especially for a picture book, that's a lot of illustration. And it is quite expensive when you're publishing a book like that yourself, if you have to pay for the illustration and editing. And I mean, there's a lot of things. I mean, I just did my own book, Sketching Here and Everywhere, and I wanted it to be professionally edited, and I wanted it to be professionally designed. I can design, but designing a book like that, I didn't have the experience of doing that type of book layout. I mean, my experience is more doing package design and, you know, some type design, but I don't do much book layout. And so when I started this book, it was important for me to get a good editor and a good designer on it. And I just happened to be lucky in Cincinnati, where I live, they used to have F&W. So for people that may not know who F&W is, if you're not into craft books and art books and that sort of thing, most of the books that you saw at Michael's, like on paper crafts and patterns and how to draw and stuff, were done by a company called FNW. So Northlight Publishing, I think, is the name of some of the imprints. And I forget, they did a lot of watercolor books and that sort of thing. Well, they went under a couple of years ago, but a designer and an editor that used to work there, the designer is a freelance designer, so I hired her to do the layout for the book. And then the editor I used, she's actually on Readsy, so she can be, that's not where I contacted her. She was suggested through people I was talking to that used to work there. But I feel like it really made it a much more professional package than if I just tried to do that myself.
That's great, great advice, because I've heard other artists who have said, oh, well, I know how to do the artwork, I can do the design layout as well. And then other people who they say, oh, well, I know how to work a computer, I'll just publish my book, but they haven't gotten it edited. And editing is so very important. But like you said, a lot of this is very expensive. And I know that I actually connected with you because you're helping a client of mine with her Kickstarter campaign. So I think you funded your own book through Kickstarter as well. Is that correct?
Yes, this is the fourth Kickstarter I've been involved in. And the first two, we decided to do a comic anthology in Cincinnati. And really, Kickstarter has turned out to be a huge blessing to comics, because it really is a way to build excitement about them, and it's a great way to get them funded. The way comics work in publishing is very different. And really, I think the rest of publishing is probably left behind a little bit by comics, because comics has always been a little bit of an independent publishing scene. I mean, yes, you have Marvel and DC, but they're like a very tiny part of what is, you know, comics. And so we, you know, funded those two. And then I also funded my book on sketching. And yes, it's a great way to pay those costs, because they're not, it's not expensive, not inexpensive to get an editor and a designer and that sort of thing, if you want them done the way they would be done at a regular traditional publishing workflow. And it's a great way also to build awareness of the book, because the thing I love about Kickstarter, and this is coming from the opinion of a gamer too, is they really have this wonderful ecosystem for, like, if you come up with a board game, there you advertise it with a bunch of different blogs and websites that are really into board games, and you get a lot of a following before you even do your board game. And I think publishing is now increasingly, I just actually saw a friend kickstarting a book the other day, and the book looked really great. It was a really cool theme. And, you know, I know she's done a lot of stuff with the traditional publishers. And I think right now what's happening is a lot of the traditional publishers are simply tapped out. I mean, we mentioned Readsy briefly, but a lot of people that used to work at Random House or used to work at Penguin or Simon & Schuster are either becoming agents or becoming freelance editors or art directors, because like every company, they've been sort of getting rid of all of the creatives and making it more of a contractor sort of workplace with a tiny skeleton crew. That seems to be sort of the, I don't know if it will reverse at some point. It'll be interesting to see where everything falls. But I'm increasingly seeing more and more people using Kickstarters for children's books. And, you know, one thing that I recently, and people listening to this obviously are interested in publishing, but I found this really great Facebook group that's called Kickstarter for Authors. And most of the people there seem to be fantasy authors, but they have the best advice there. Like, they really study how to kickstart a book. And it really is a great place to go to get a lot of information that might be hard to find in one place anywhere else.
Great. That's great. I'm sure a lot of people will love to have that, that tip to go to that Facebook group.
Oh, they're great.
Any other advice for people, for authors that are wanting to get on to getting on the Kickstarter?
Well, you know, obviously getting on a Facebook group like that. I mean, there's tons of Facebook groups that are, and some are more useful than others. I think the reason why this one has more usefulness is they really, a lot of these authors really break down what worked, what didn't, you know, how much should you set the Kickstarter for? How much should the rewards be? What about video? Where can, and then they can also share resources for if you're getting bookmarks done or if you're getting stickers or pins or, you know, whatever you need to do. I mean, I would recommend before you do a Kickstarter, do a ton of research and not just reading articles about Kickstarter, but actually go to the Kickstarter site and see what's there and see what's doing well. Because that's one of the most important aspects when you're first setting it up. I mean, you have to do a lot of groundwork before you do it and try to get enough people to, I mean, follow your project before it starts and get like that includes getting mailing lists, you know, doing, you know, PR. Yeah. Social media, PR. If you can get some news stations locally to cover you, that's always really great. I mean, it really, I think the thing that is probably hardest for people when they do a Kickstarter is that it's relentless. You can't just like plop a Kickstarter on the platform and then check on it in 30 days.
Well, what about your book? Why don't you give a pitch for your book?
Oh, which one? The one, the sketching book?
Yeah.
Or Hadori?
Either one.
Oh, okay. Well, you know, since Hadori's actually live, I'll mention that first, and then I can kind of circle back to Sketching Here and Everywhere. I mean, the thing I love about Shari's books, and I've worked with Shari before, I illustrated her book for the San Diego Zoo for their centennial, which it was their official children's book, and it was really fun. And she does with this particular series of books, it has music with it. So she's a musician and an actress, and she has a lot of experience in the arts beyond being a writer. And I love that it has sheet music in it, and it's, and the way she's written the story, it has a very nice flow. It has a very easy to follow story. It, I think, is a good one to read to kids because it's got sound effects and that sort of thing. There's a lot, I think, that sells it as a children's book. And I think this series is really good. And I think Shari has worked really hard to get the word out there. So we're pretty close to our goal now. And I'm excited to see where it goes. You know, hopefully we'll get to some of those stretch goals.
Well, one of the things that I like when I was looking at Shari's book and your other illustrations, one of the things I really admire is, and coming from a writing point of view, you know, we have to get into characters and you really do that when you illustrate. I love the expressions that you put on faces. You have a real talent for putting expressions on faces.
Oh, thank you.
So how do you do that?
A lot of practice. I think there's a lot of intuition in illustration, and especially when I'm painting animals, but when you're painting anyone, you want it to have a lot of heart, and you really want to pay attention to how you're interpreting what people are getting from the reaction or action. And I love painting animals because it's like, it's sort of a fine line between being a little bit too caricature and being realistic. My work is a little bit more realistic than a lot of, you know, you see a lot of more, I want to say, stylized work. This has a lot of realism to it, but I try to make it not photorealistic. I try to give it a bit more, there's a lot of caricature sort of imbued into the different animals. So it kind of starts crossing over very, very subtly into cartoon area. You have to exaggerate enough to, which I've always thought illustration done best is exaggerated. I mean, obviously, if it's not exaggerated at all, you would just use photos. But the thing that's, I always compare illustration, I always tell my students that when you're doing illustration, you have to kind of think of it like opera, especially like when you're thinking fantasy illustration. But I think with children's books, there's a bit of that too, where everything is bigger than life. And I think that that's always important, no matter what you're illustrating. And that's why, you know, when you see a lot of, say, fantasy stuff or superhero or science fiction artwork, it's always the hair's blowing back and they're wearing these giant costumes and stuff. It's sort of got that big theatrical production. And, you know, you kind of try to have that even with a book on animals. You don't want it, like, if things are too subtle, I think it makes it a little bit harder to tell what's going on. And so that's sort of the I guess abbreviated way to approach it. I mean, and also I do a lot of drawing just in general. I mean, I think if you want to get into illustration, you have to love drawing and putting together characters. And I like to draw almost anything. I'm a huge urban sketcher. I sketch at the zoo every month. I will be sketching Friday at the Cincinnati Zoo. And actually, they have some of the most photogenic hippos at the Cincinnati Zoo that, I mean, you know, when you look at pictures of hippos, like when I was putting this together, most of them are very scary looking. You know, they have these big teeth and they look very aggressive. And the hippos, Fiona and Fritz at the Cincinnati Zoo and their mother, Bibi, have kind of the sweetest expressions I think I've ever seen on a hippo. Like Fiona, I don't know if you heard the story. She was a hippo that was born 3 years ago at the Cincinnati Zoo, and she has become world famous because she was a preemie. They didn't think she was going to live, so she had to go to the children's hospital, and they saved her life, and she's used to being handled, so she's very friendly and is very reactive to people watching her that come to her tank. And so they absolutely love her. She swims, she plays, she kind of makes to the camera. You see all these wonderful videos of her. And then her brother Fritz was just born last year, and he was sort of a surprise pregnancy of Bibi. And it's terrible to be three and being usurped by someone cuter and younger, but poor Fiona kind of is, because now you have Fritz and he's cuter and littler.
Wow, that sounds like a children's story in the making.
Oh, there have been many people have done children's books already about Fiona. I'm sure Fritz is coming. I mean, he's a little bit young. I'm sure there's ones coming. What is his name? I think it's Rob Corddry has been doing a series of Fiona books that they have in the stores, and they're really very charming.
So, how do you when somebody comes to you with a story, or a company comes to you with a story, how do you go about thinking about how you're going to illustrate it?
It really depends what type of book it is. You know, obviously when someone first comes to me with a story, and I'm happy to work with independent publishers, you know, I have a pricing structure for how I get paid for my illustrations. And if people are willing to meet, you know, and if I like the story, I mean, a lot of that depends too, you know, if the story is something I would actually want to illustrate, you know. So I get people contacting me almost every week asking me to do something. And so it's nice to be able to kind of pick and choose the projects that I want to do. And usually if it's an animal book in particularly, I usually do a lot of research, and that might mean sketching the animal and taking pictures of them. It might be, you know, sometimes I've traveled places to do research. I've done some books, like I did a book for the Rocky Mountain Elk Foundation and the U.S. Forest Service. I think it was it came out in 2012, I think. No, 2012 or 10, I can't remember. But anyway, I went out to Missoula, Montana, and met with the elk team and learned a lot about elk. They actually gave me a textbook that was like this thick. It was like 2 inches thick about elk. It was everything about elk you could ever imagine. And the author I had worked with on my Henry the Impatient Heron book, she had written that. And she had to kind of distill this into a book for kids that 8 to 12. And then it was more informational. So something like that, you're doing more research. I went and met with somebody from the Elk Foundation in Kentucky, and he took me on like a drive through where they're reintroducing elk in Kentucky. And I took pictures of them there and got some great reference pictures. I did a book for Arbordale that was called Little Red Bat. And when the editor called me up and asked if I wanted to do it, I had never heard of them before because we're more used to brown bats, but red bats are very ubiquitous throughout the Midwest, you know, Cincinnati, Indiana, Ohio. But you don't ever hear about them because they don't live in your house. You know, people often are get bats in their houses that are little brown bats that like live in your chimney or whatever, but red bats live in trees. And so most people aren't aware of them. And so they're so tiny and so hard to photograph. I ended up hooking up with a bat rescuer and he had rescued a family of red bats. And so I was able to shoot video of them and took pictures of them. Since I was going to be doing a book that had 20 paintings of them, obviously you want to get them correct, especially the way I execute them. But even if you were doing them cartoony, it sort of helps to have good reference. And if it's a story that's more character driven, I'll often do sketches of the characters and send them and we'll kind of talk to the author, depending on the publisher. A lot of big publishers don't let you talk to the author. It really depends on how their setup is. Sometimes there's books I've done artwork for that I've never talked to or met the author.
But I'm sure that you do get approached by people who, well, and sounds like you're pretty busy. So you probably don't have time for many independent authors or people who are doing it themselves, but maybe you have other illustrators who get approached a lot by indie authors who want to put out their own book and they've got their story. What kind of advice do you have for authors who want to find an illustrator?
Well, I think the most important thing is to do your research. There actually is a document, and I'll have to see if I can find a link. Somebody had done a document a couple of years ago about things to know when you're contracting an illustrator, because if you've never worked with an illustrator or contracted art before, it can be really difficult because you don't actually know. You're giving this person your manuscript and asking them to interpret it. And I think one of the best ways to prepare is to, you know, do some research, maybe even listen to podcasts, learn how artists work. I mean, usually now, especially if I'm working with independent artists, independent authors, but actually I started doing this with Shari and I think it works really well. You actually thumbnail the book first before you sit down and do very formal sketches to kind of get the flow of the book and figure out what's in your mind, what's in the author's mind, what's in the publisher's mind, because it kind of gives you, before you spend hours and hours, I think the biggest thing about illustration, even if it's a fairly simple style that most authors don't know, is just how much time it takes to do. Illustrating a children's book is kind of like running a marathon. And there is so much to think about besides just, you know, you're basically making a movie. So you have to think about what's the setting? What are the costumes? What do all the characters look like? What do the animals look like? Where do they live? You know, if it's a book, you know, specifically about an animal, what can I put in that environment that is actually in that environment? What kind of plants, what kind of trees? And, you know, if it's a character, you have to make sure the continuity is, you know, correct. You know, if a character has jewelry, that she has to be wearing that in every picture. You know, there's just so much that you have to think about when you're doing the artwork. And so as an author, I think it's good to be cognizant about all of the efforts that it takes for an illustrator, because I think a lot of times all people see is the cost of how much it costs to commission an illustrator without realizing that probably, you know, especially with an art style like, you know, mine, which is takes a little bit longer. I mean, it can take a couple months to finish the illustrations of doing nothing else. And so if you extrapolate that out to, you know, what you have to do to make a living, it's not going to be something that's going to be like $100 or something like that, you know. And I think a lot of people don't realize how much. And actually, I went through the same thing just recently when I was getting editors, you know, getting my editor and designer. I mean, I didn't know how much it cost to do that. And it cost quite a bit more than I thought it was. But then I was kind of like, well, what do I know about how long it takes to do this stuff. You know, I've never edited a book before, and you know, this is a book that had particularly a lot to edit. And I think part of it is just being educated on how to communicate with them, you know, how to let them execute their artistic vision without hovering too much, but getting what you want. I mean, it really is teamwork between whoever's commissioning the art and the artist. And it's interesting because publishers for a long time, and I don't know if this is changing, but most of the time, unless you're some sort of well-known person, you have no say in the art at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand in a way why they do that, but I've known a lot of people that have been dissatisfied.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that is one good thing about indie publishing too, is you can, you know, commission an artist that you want and get the style that you want and that sort of thing. And, you know,
that's true. I mean, and a lot of this that you're talking about with illustrators, kind of correlates to the last interview I did with an audiobook narrator.
And oh, cool.
Thing where you don't realize, oh, you think, oh, somebody else is going to read your book. Well, they have to do their preparation. They do their, you know, like the illustrator does their research and their prep work. A narrator has to do their prep work and their research. And it's not just reading, it's getting into the characters and getting it right. And with publishers, a lot of publishers won't let the authors choose their narrator. And with indie, a client of mine had his book was a hybrid publisher. And so the hybrid publisher picked some narrators for him to listen to. And so he could kind of have a say in it. And other publishers, I think, let you submit your own audition so that they can see if maybe you can do your own narration, and they let you have a little bit of a say in it, at least.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting angle, and that's something to think about. It's interesting that you mentioned that, because on my podcast that I do for my Patreon, I recently interviewed someone. She's an illustrator, but she also writes novels, and she was getting an audiobook of one of her books, and she is doing it through Audible, and she had 63 auditions to go through.
Wow. That's a lot.
I know, that sounded very overwhelming to me. And she said it was really hard. It was like picking out a portfolio or something like that. It was something that, like you said, you don't really give that much thought to, but there have been, I mean, talking about the way the industry's changed, I very rarely read novels anymore. I mostly listen to them on Audible. And sometimes the reader can make a huge difference.
Yes, definitely. Definitely. I've been listening for quite a while myself. Yeah. So do you want to tell us about your podcasts?
Oh, yeah. I could go into that. So I have two podcasts. The first one is called Hometown Haunts, and I do that with my friends, Jennifer Kohler and Kat Kloko, which Kat Kloko used to be on a radio show, paranormal radio show, and she edits the comic series that we first kickstarted, and she's sort of the expert on everything paranormal, and Jen and I sort of are color commentary to sort of, she does all the research. It's kind of like she writes a research paper each week and then we discuss it. And a lot of it focuses on regional Cincinnati, Indiana, Kentucky history, a little bit of true crime, cryptids and that sort of thing. And that's just a lot of fun. And then we did that sort of as it's a way to keep talking about the comic, because they're actually putting together the third issue right now, and keep it on people's radar, even when it's not coming out at that moment. And I started a podcast called Sketchy Talk for my Patreon, because I love talking to other artists and discussing sketching practice and art practice. And it was a nice way to add something to my Patreon that didn't require as much artwork for me, because I tend to get really, really booked for, like, I have commitments to like 2025 at the moment. And so, yeah. You know, I try to, it's a way to kind of keep me, and that's actually why I got into urban sketching, because I love to sketch just for me. And it's a way to keep me really excited about drawing and doing my, I think it's always important as a creator to not just do stuff for other people, but you have to do stuff for yourself too.
Is that what your book is about?
That's what Sketching Here and Everywhere is about. Yes. I think it's talks about how I came to urban sketching and keeping sketchbooks in general. And I have exercises for people to sort of learn how to get into sketching. And, you know, sketching, like a lot of pursuits, music, or if you want to do dance or whatever, you know, a lot of times very rarely are people, especially with the sort of gig economy that's come up, you're not encouraged to do something just for the joy of doing it. And the thing I love about sort of the urban sketching movement is it doesn't matter how good you are at drawing. The whole thing is the act of observing and being outside. And there's so much more to it than just doing artwork. And the book kind of tells you how to get into that. And I've always liked the manifesto of urban sketchers, which is sort of to encourage you, no matter what your skill level is, to go out and draw. Because, you know, before everybody had a cell camera with them, you know, people actually used to keep journals and used to keep, and I'm not saying people don't do that anymore, but it was probably a more common practice because, like, a lot of scientists, when they go, they do field guides, field journals, and that sort of thing. And when you observe something, whether it's a building or, you know, a butterfly or, you know, an insect across your path and you decide to sketch it, you observe it and remember it a lot better than if you just snapped a picture of it. And so I think that practice, I think, is helpful to a lot of people. And it's very analogous to if people are into music or if people are into dance. Like, if you keep this just for yourself, like, you don't have to do it as a professional pursuit. You can do it just because it's something you love to do, like doing puzzles, or, you know, it's a creative pursuit that is more enriching for your soul than to just do something because you're wanting to be compensated for it.
Well, so along that line, do you have any advice for young people or people of any age, actually, who want to break in as an illustrator?
Yes, I think that if you want to be an illustrator, the most important advice I can give somebody is draw the stuff that you want to draw. Don't expect people to hire you to do work based on something that you want to do, but it's not your portfolio. It seems like a lot of people, when they get started, they say, oh, I want to do movie posters for this, or I want to do book covers. But then in their portfolio, they have nothing in there that relates to what they say they want to do. So because of the internet, any art director has thousands of choices of people they can hire. And so if they're wanting to do a book cover with a tiger on it, they're going to pick people that have painted tigers that they like and commission them to do that. They're not, if all you have in your portfolio is, you know, pictures of kites or pictures of, I mean, I whatever you have, if it's not what they're looking for, they're not going to hire you. So I highly recommend you put, like, if you, and we used to always have a saying, like, if you don't like to draw cars or bicycles, don't put them in your portfolio because people will hire you to draw them. And if it's something you don't want to draw, you know, don't do that. I mean, literally, you will get hired to do books based on something that you have in your portfolio, because what happens is when somebody's finding someone to do their book, they fall in love with a piece that this illustrator has done and they want that for their book. And so if you're just doing artwork because you just want to kind of tick off boxes and say, oh, I heard if you draw X, Y, and Z, and, you know, a lot of, and I know this kind of probably flies in the face a little bit of a lot of advice people get at conferences and stuff, and I understand where they're coming from. The problem is that you want to create your best work and you want to get work doing what you want to do. And if you do work that's what you think, as a matter of fact, there's a Venn diagram I always show my students, and it has the crossover, what people tell you should be in a portfolio, what you have in your portfolio, and then, you know, what you want to do. It's like, it's like a whole totally different you know, circle that's not intersecting. And so I think that you have to, and I think especially today, if you, there's a passion that you have, you can make a book about it without having to go through anyone. And I think that's kind of exciting. And it's also kind of daunting too, because it's again, a very transitional phase, because it used to be when you started an illustration, it was much more, I don't want to use the word transactional, but it was probably a lot more clear cut how you got work and how you approached people. And, you know, you used to drop your portfolio off it. You could go, and you can actually still do portfolio drop offs, but, you know, at publishers in New York. But now with the internet, how people find your work, it's a whole different sort of random way that you are connected to people that want to publish your work. And sometimes, you know, publishing your own stuff is a road to getting the type of work that you want. I mean, I would say if you're breaking in, don't get frustrated and keep at it. Do the work that you want. You know, start thinking about, if you want to do children's books, start doing artwork that's sequential, for one thing, that tells stories. You know, and actually, that's a great way to familiarize yourself with what this type of assignment is, because obviously doing a picture book or a comic is a very different project from if you're just doing a magazine cover or a piece of spot art for something. And knowing how much work it is for each project is useful too when you're getting started.
Yeah, that might be, that's actually an interesting concept. It might be if maybe there's a children's book that you find that you like the children's book, but you don't like the illustrations. Well, do your own illustrations as kind of an example of how you can illustrate a book.
Yes.
What great advice. This has been just so interesting. And I really encourage people to check out your website and see, look at your beautiful illustrations. What is your website?
ChristinaWald.com. So it's really easy.
Yeah, it is. Well, thank you so much. This has been delightful.